Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture.
Success doesn't always mean sticking with one path. Sometimes it means starting over. Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Zoe Paskin, the restaurateur behind some of London's most well-known venues, including the Palomar, Evelyn's Table, and the Barbary. In this episode, we discuss reinvention, building multiple brands, and the realities of running a restaurant business in a rapidly changing environment. Today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Zoe Paskin. Zoe is the co-founder and managing director of Studio Paskin, one of the most influential independent hospitality groups in the UK. And Zoe works alongside her brother, which I'd like to talk to you about later. Zoe's interested in that, the dynamics of that. And Studio Paskin is behind several acclaimed restaurants, including the Palomar, which is in London, Soho, the Barbary, which is in Covent Garden in London, and also Notting Hill, near where I live, and Evelyn's Table in Soho, which is a Michelin star rated restaurant. And I just looked it up, and it's also rated 4.9 on TripAdvisor. So even more highly rated than our podcast, which makes me envious. And it's not easy to get a 4.9 rating on TripAdvisor, is it? No, well, thanks for coming in, Zoe. I know you're really busy, and I'm really interested and excited to learn more about your business. But what sort of strikes me is that you're expanding in restaurants at a time when lots of people are saying, oh, it's really tough out there. So how come, and what's your sort of magic formula, if there is one?
It is really tough out there. Well, at the moment, we are doing a lot of consolidating in this current year, everything from guest experience all the way through, with the hope that we can do something next year. So our journey really began with the Palomar, and then our last opening was in 2024. So we're going to go a little bit more slowly while we find our feet in the current marketplace, but we are hoping to do something next year for sure.
But I applaud you on what you've done so far. Really highly rated restaurants that are giving a lot of people a lot of pleasure. You started out, though, in a slightly, well, an adjacent but different line of business, which was nightclubs, was it not?
It was, yeah.
What's the origin story of Studio Paskin?
Okay, so I've got an older brother who's ended up being my co-founder, and there's a few years between us.
What's his name?
His name's Leo right. Paskin, and he is part of the dance at Leo and Bushwacker. So in my teens, he was coming out of university. He was really into dance music, and everything in that era was breaking then. He was going to lots of warehouse parties. And once he graduated, he said to my father, who's an architect, if you come across any sites before they get developed where I could throw a warehouse party, let me know.
Were these sort of raves?
Yes. So some months later, my dad came home one day and was like, well, I've actually found working on a site, and on top of everything else, they actually think it might be suitable for a nightclub. So the naughty innocence of maybe throwing a rave became the possibility of opening a nightclub. But they didn't have any money. There wasn't, you know, but slowly he got together the people he knew in dance music, one of which was Mr. C, who was a fan of the Shaman. And without hesitation, he put the money down for the lease. And slowly but surely, they raised the money.
So where was this and what was it called?
It was called The End.
The End.
And it was not far from here. It was on the back of Drury Lane on a back street called West Central Street.
Right.
And so my dad was the architect of that nightclub. And in 1995, they opened the doors and kind of changed the course of everything, really, because I was at university by then, obviously. And then I was sort of like, didn't really want to just follow like exactly in those footsteps. So I actually went to live in Spain for a while. And then my brother needed some help, and that really changed the course of everything. So I went home for a month.
So he was running The End at this point?
Yes.
Yeah. And he asked you to join him?
Yeah.
So what was going on? Why did he need help? What was your particular sort of supporting act, if that's the right way to describe it at this point?
So I think they'd gone from like all the sort of like the energy of like underground dance music and opened this incredible venue that was designed by clubbers, for clubbers.
In the sort of heyday of clubbing.
In the heyday, yeah. And but it was probably a little bit ahead of its time. So converting that into a business and sort of his own career was beginning to take off.
Well, he was doing another job.
Well, he was a DJ and producer himself.
Oh, so
the beginning
kept,
of a career that did
that.
Take off, exactly. Yeah. So in the one end, it had a decent turnover, but, you know, it was hemorrhaging money, really. They'd also opened a venue next door called AKA. It was in year one, and he was just overwhelmed. He'd done all this in his early 20s. He's an incredibly creative person, but all of the other skills around managing a team and business, well, right. He didn't have particularly in his wheelhouse yet, and also didn't really have time to do it. I had perhaps a teeny bit more of that, but mostly led by instinct, really, than experience.
Well, you were young yourself,
I was young. I was younger. I still am. Yeah. My brother always. He always likes to pretend it's the other way around. But
you'll always be younger than him.
Yeah.
So, but you'd been in Spain. What were you doing there before you came?
I had gone out there. I'd graduated in psychology. I think I still thought I wanted to be a psychotherapist, but I was like having a year off. Wanted to learn another language. I was taking the work I could get because my Spanish was pretty beginners. Yeah. So I was painting, decorating, converting bars in the old town. And really just making ends meet and having quite a good time. I just kind of renovated a sort of apartment, you know, right. Buying things from the flea market. It was, you know, it was the beginning of my career, really. Not even the beginning of my career. But I'd done a lot of work in bars and restaurants, you know, throughout my degree. When I had graduated, I'd gone to work at Brown's in St. Martin's Lane, which was about a 350-cover restaurant. So I'd learned quite a few of the basics of...
So you were just soaking it all in, really?
I was soaking it all in, and it was hot in Barcelona at the time that we met. We actually met up in Ibiza for me to do the guest list for a tour they were doing, which is when it all came out that he was feeling like there's a lot to do. So I offered to come home for a month.
Right.
And that led to a partnership of 10 years.
So a month turned into 10 years.
Totally, like...
Running the end in Camden.
Yeah, I said to my boyfriend, I'll be back, you know, in a month. And then, I mean, we always joke, I sort of landed, I went straight to a meeting, and it was so obvious so quickly I wasn't going to be going back. And it had all of the sort of innocence of learning on the jobs, but with, like, unbelievable speed.
So what were the immediate challenges that you faced doing that?
Well, I began really working on AKA next door so that he could concentrate on the club. So they had different challenges. The end had built up debt that we needed to sort out, whereas AK was a year old. And whilst in some ways it had, you know, already, it was like, again, it was a bit ahead of the curve. It was like the first DJ bar, but it had a really quite refined restaurant on the mezzanine floor.
Oh, so it was a bar and restaurant.
Yeah. So it was, and really it needed to take more, the restaurant and the ground floor were fighting one another. So there was like the cultural piece of how they're going to work, sit together. And so slowly sort of working away at what the offering was, adding to that offering, the programming, and then just everything from sort of what we were spending on flowers through to cutlery, crockery, the team we had. You know, there's always bad actors in a team when there's problems, slowly getting the right people to fit all the seats of the place.
So when you say bad actors, you had to sort of weed some people out of the team.
Yeah.
What sort of bad things were they doing?
Well, in that particular project, there was it was the era of, you know, incredible mixology in London, but there was, you know, people that were just obviously there was people with their hand in the till at the time, or, you know, that their career was ahead of the business itself. We needed to create a heart to that business. So in many ways, it needed someone to really nurture it. And I guess that was where I stepped in. I looked at everything from what we were spending through to...
But this is interesting advice for anyone who finds themselves in a turnaround situation, which kind of, I'm assuming this is, or it sounds like it is.
Yeah.
So you have to look at every detail, you're saying, really.
Every single thing. I mean, I guess everything we were spending money on or had spent money on. So like next time we were going to buy cutlery, what would it cost? Because they had really expensive cutlery. Did we need that level of flowers coming to a business like that? Linen? You know, when... you're losing money, it's amazing how much more money you can lose. And once you start protecting it and then nurturing it, the dial can move as well. So it was really just all that attention to detail, the programming to draw people to West Central Street. And it really then in that following year with working with my brother as well and the team and programming, it became more of a DJ bar as well as this lovely restaurant on the first floor and just a bar downstairs.
So you did this, you say, for a decade?
I ended up doing it for a decade. I got back in 99 and then in about 15 months, the club was in a lot of debt and my brother's career was really taking off in music. And we had an offer on the table to sell to Mean Fiddler. But I just really didn't think we should do it. And we were kind of, loggerheads about it.
You and your brother?
We were.
Was he in favour of selling and you weren't? Was it the other way around?
Yeah, I think at that point he couldn't see his way through it all. And he didn't think, as we were close to having to present it to the shelves, I don't think he could fully see the way through it when you're deep in problems in business. I'm sure anyone that's been there, it can get very, very overwhelming. But it was so incredible what had been created there and had so much potential and opportunity. Although I didn't think I was the person, I believe we should try and find a managing director.
Right.
And in the end, in the minutes before the shareholders' extraordinary general meeting to take it to the shareholders, he finally said, well, let's see what they can decide, whether they want to find a new MD or take this offer on the table.
Did you know that there are nearly 1 million 18 to 24-year-olds who are currently not in education, employment or training in the UK? This is simply not good enough, and I want to do something about it. That's why Reed is launching a new initiative giving £20,000 to young entrepreneurs to help them grow their small business. Visit reed.com/entrepreneurs to find out more. We want to support and encourage the next generation of entrepreneurs. So this was a situation that was decided by the shareholders. So who were the shareholders then?
They were a mixture of, some music, Mr. C, music contacts of his, few family members, just people, business contacts of my dad.
So this was
a lot of small shareholders, about 30 shareholders.
This was a meeting that was held then.
Yeah.
What to decide what to do.
Yeah.
And one option was to sell to the Mean Fiddler.
Yeah.
And the other was to carry on and appoint a managing director.
Presented the offer and I didn't really yet officially work on the M, but I then presented the offer of let's find a new MD and try and turn it around. It's a risk. We owe lots of people money. We're in about £1.5 million worth of debt, which in 99 was a lot of money.
Still is.
It still is, but it was a lot more money then.
Yeah.
And the shareholders decided to go with my option.
So you put your heart on the tape. So there's a lot weighing on you then now.
No one was thinking it would be me. I certainly wasn't.
Did you become the manager?
I became the managing director.
Pitched that we need a managing director, and then you ended up being the manager. That's good. That's clever.
It wasn't the original plan.
How did that come about? The shareholders said, why didn't you do it, Zoe? Or what was
it? It was just before Christmas. It was the 21st, I think, of December. And we said we sort of pick it up in the new year. I sort of got on with the turnaround work as I saw it then. And we started having meetings in the new year for managing directors. They're not easy to find someone to give the keys to your business. And the months went by and I was just working on the business like I had on the business next door. If I'm honest, I can't really remember how it morphed. It just probably it's quite a long time ago. I think just slowly I wasn't doing it consciously. It just became my role. And then it was working.
And you're the managing director today of your studio, Baskin Group. So you've carried on in that vein.
Yeah.
But then this business, this nightclub business, you ended up selling it. Is that right? What happened? What was the story there?
So, it was obviously an incredible decade. But we were wondering how to, what next? We hadn't worked that all out. And then we got an offer to exit the business because it was on a kind of island that backs off New Oxford Street, and we had many years left in our lease, but we were now incredibly successful, so the offer had to be quite compelling to get us to leave our lease early. And so looking at that offer and what we'd have to live
Did someone want to redevelop the site? Oh, I see.
It was a compelling offer.
They just needed you to move on.
They wanted to knock it down and develop it basically.
So what happened?
well, it was the plan, but then it was, by the time we actually completed, which there was a long exchange of completion, it was summer 2009, and there was a crash, and it just, their whole development plan fell apart. And then it's ended up, then some people took over temporarily as a nightclub, which was pretty heartbreaking, and called it The Den instead of The End, and they lost the license pretty quickly. Right. And it was an incredible 24-hour license by that stage. Anyway, it then sort of sat really empty for a long time. Upstairs was apartments. And literally very recently, they finally knocked it down. So that we closed the doors at the end of January 2009, and it's just now. And
17 years later.
Yeah, it's quite
extraordinary. The project is underway for a variety of reasons. So you were given a good price, you say, to exit the property, the premises, but that meant the end of The End, it seems. Is that right?
It is, and I guess it was a decision of the head rather than the heart, because I think after that, suddenly, we closed the doors, and I literally...
So are you thinking, sitting here now, I wish we hadn't done that?
We sometimes have these conversations.
Knowing what you know now, knowing what I know now,
nightlife has changed dramatically in the country. I could definitely have run it for a few more years.
Yeah.
I would have to have begun again, whatever. And I guess what I know now, and there's perhaps a bit more naivety at that point, is that the role I had and what we were doing and the standards we were doing it to within the genre was so extraordinary. So to suddenly find myself without any of that purpose and identity was a massive change.
And this is what happens to people who sell businesses. Well, so you felt without purpose and identity because you didn't have that to go into and run.
And it was a really exciting job. You know, on the one hand, it was obviously an all-night venue and I was enjoying it all night and all those things. But I took my job really seriously. I turned the company around. I worked incredibly well with my brother. We had an amazing team, loyal following. It was heady times, but you know, really serious enterprise at the same time. And all of that changed. And I didn't really know what my skills were at that time, because I'm probably quite a generalist in many ways. And I didn't know that in itself was an asset.
So I've heard the phrase seller's remorse. Is that, does that mean anything? Does that strike a chord with you?
Look, with endings, you're always going to feel like that until you find the new thing.
That was what you needed to do.
Yeah.
And you realized that, I guess.
Yeah.
So then, what happened? So you'd sold The End. And you were thinking about.
So I planned to take the first period off. So I took a year out, just doing all sorts of things I wanted to do, and then I started trying to find the new project. And the world had crashed as well. So, and I would be given all sorts of introductions, but maybe without clear idea of why. And I just, nothing really happened. And I didn't really know where to put myself because, you know, I'd fast-tracked so many things. And I'd cared passionately when I'd gone to help Leo because it was my brother. My brother and dad had created this thing. So I was giving more of myself than I could ever have imagined. It was so sort of instinctive in so many ways. So, yeah, I my flame was beginning to go out a bit after sort of several months of not quite knowing, not finding the right thing.
What were you doing? I mean, how were you passing the time?
Well, I did do a couple of short-term projects on business turnaround and people that knew me. So I did bits and pieces. I was going to introductions, sometimes interviews. And I was remembering a particularly difficult one.
What interview?
Yeah. I went for about 5 interviews for a job once.
What was going across your mind when you were remembering the
difficult? Well, I got told at the end of it that it was a job in the end for a general manager of a restaurant, and that I had quite a difficult final interview, and the CEO that interviewed me, not the founder, said that I didn't know enough about running restaurants. So I was remembering it because I then went on to open a restaurant. So it was just quite funny. But all of it was quite difficult at the time.
Was that person right or wrong?
Well, I'd like to think I learned enough to run restaurants. I mean,
well, you do now.
Obviously wrong.
Obviously.
Yeah. Now, as time has told, that's often the way. So what did I do? So then the difference between making some money versus life-changing figures. I had some money in the bank, but obviously I had been spending it to live. I think my brother, maybe more than I at that stage, had an idea that maybe we should move into restaurants. And he was like, look, why don't you go and waitress? You have structured your days. You won't erode all your capital. You're free to go to all sorts of meetings, dot, dot, dot.
All right. So that's what you did.
So that's what I did.
Where did you work?
So I dumbed down my CV and I got...
You dumbed down your CV?
Well, yeah, like, because I was worried I wouldn't... I was 35. I wasn't, you know, a spring chicken in front of house terms.
Right. So this is interesting. So you had to make yourself look less qualified.
Well, I felt like I needed to, yeah. I thought I might... Right. People wouldn't really know what to do with me. And actually, I wrote to about 10 restaurants with my CV and I think I only got offered one trial.
Right.
So there must have been something in it.
So then you changed your CV.
Well, no, then I went to that trial and I
got... Oh, so that was with the dumbed down CV. Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah. That was with the dumbed down CV. So then I got the
trial.
Job. Then I got the trial and then I got the job.
And where was that?
Hawksmoor.
Hawksmoor. Tell me about Hawksmoor.
So, I mean, great place to have found myself. And
but for people who don't know, what sort of restaurant
right,
is it?
Hawksmoor, yeah. Well, it's... probably one of the best in the country and even possibly the leading in the world restaurant built around steak.
So if you want to eat steak, go to Hawksmoor.
Yeah, if you want to eat steak, go to Hawksmoor. They do it incredibly well. It's an amazing organisation and very grateful that I crossed paths with it.
So how long did you work there?
It wasn't that long in the end. It was probably about 15, 16 months.
Yeah. But you were thinking about your next move.
Well, what ended up happening was I quickly got promoted first to AGM, Assistant General Manager, and then presently to General Manager. So I took over the site, the first site they did, actually.
This just keeps happening to you, doesn't it? What's the aura you give off? Because it might be helpful for people to know this. I just keep getting promoted to run things.
Well, I guess because I'd already run a business, I had an idea. So while I was with them, I was learning a bit more about restaurants and details specifically. But I was really unhappy. And I think presently, I didn't know there, but I didn't know when I went there, but I guess I learned... however good a company I was in, that I didn't really want to work for anyone in a conventional employee way again. I wanted to be answerable to partners, my team, but I, having done 10 years running a business, I couldn't really go and do that again.
You wanted to be your own boss.
I wanted to be my own person, my own boss. So, and I went away for a couple of weeks to really sit with it and think about it. And I thought, well, I've got a year to try and earn this salary in terms of how my life was arranged at the time. So I've got a year to do that. And I went back and apologized to Will, but said I needed to go and do something else. And not long after, we decided to open a restaurant.
Right. You and your brother again. So the old team was put back
together.
The old
team was back together.
Right. And how did you go about doing that? So if someone wants to just open a restaurant, what do they need to think about?
Well,
it sounds like a big deal to me.
Yeah. he was still doing a lot of performing. So we went away together to have a few days just to sort of brainstorm the like what, how, where. And then we went back to a restaurant we really liked and met some chefs that wanted to do something in London. So that created the in really to do a project in London, which was going to be a pop up. But then in the end, to do anything to the standards you want to do it and all the components of opening a restaurant, we were like, let's just go all in.
Mm.
And that, so beginning of the following year, we decided to look for a site in London. And after a few second places with landlords, we got offered the site that became the Palomar on Rupert Street.
And that was your first venture?
Yeah.
And then, how long were you running the Palomar before you then added to the portfolio?
2 years later, we opened the Barbary, so it was pretty quick. I mean, the Palomar was a pretty incredible opening, we felt.
So describe the Palomar to people who haven't been there.
So the Palomar is a smallest restaurant in Rupert Street, which is really defined by the kitchen bar. And then at the back, we have a dining room. There's also a terrace. It's about 45 covers. It's a restaurant with an awful lot of atmosphere, very warm, sort of intoxicating feel to the service and hospitality. It's a place I think you'd have a really good time.
Yeah. And the kitchen bar is like a bar, you said.
Yeah, kitchen bar. So that the kitchen is there and you're sitting literally in front of the chefs. Actually, we've made some changes over the years. That's now got sort of 19 seats in front of the chefs.
Right. But, and people like that, that was a sort of innovation of yours in a way.
Well, no, there were
other it's not exclusive.
No, you, there are other people doing it well. I mean, I'd lived in Barcelona, so I think I'd first come across it a lot there.
Yes.
And then here, peers that, you know, hold in incredibly high regard, like Barrafina, had really done that incredibly well as well. I mean, all of us have done it slightly differently. But I think the Palomar ended up being, having with our music, the sort of background that we had in music, it was a place that had an awful lot of energy and atmosphere and is quite well known for playlist and so on. And so all of our experiences, I guess, came into play in that.
So Zoe, so that got off to a good start, the Palomar. But interestingly to me, you decided, as you said, to open your next restaurant and call it the Barbary. So it's not like, you know, the Ivy, where they've recreated a lot of ivies all over the place. You decided to do another concept in the Barbary, which is a strategic choice. Why did you do that? What made you take that route?
I guess ultimately at that time, and probably part of how we like to work is, it's there's a lot in designing something, you know, from scratch rather than replicating it. And I think at that point in the beginning of this career, restaurant career, you're not thinking about all the things that I might now be thinking about. So we wanted to do something that wouldn't compete with the Palomar, but would be as beloved. So yeah, we weren't thinking about scale then at all. And certainly at the time, I don't think we even would have used the word portfolio, but in essence, that's what's happened. We've built a portfolio of things that express our interests in.
So the Barbary, you've opened it more recently, a second one, which I enjoy, in Notting Hill. You describe sort of Mediterranean, or the Barbary Coast is North Africa.
Yeah, it's sort of where Southern Europe meets North Africa, as a loose way to lean into all the ingredients. It's built around cooking with fire. So the breads, I mean, the original Barbary, you know, we've got the tandoor for the breads. This one, we've got the Ghosni. Cooking with fire, and then the ingredients sort of build out.
What's a Ghosni?
It's a very special type of oven. In fact, we've got, I think we've got.
Is that how the delicious bread is cooked?
Yes. Yeah. At the Notting Hill one.
It is superb. Thank you. Yeah. It's really delicious. Anyone listening should try it. And, and your coffee rub chicken.
That's a signature, yeah.
Is it? Yeah. That's superb as well. I've never heard of that before I went there, but it's really delicious. So these are sort of Mediterranean, North African themed dishes.
Yeah.
So it struck me as really carefully thought through, and the service there is very good. There's a lot of attention to detail, I've observed, in the way you run the Barbary.
I think in a good restaurant experience, I guess these are all the things that either you don't notice because they are going well, or when we're getting it wrong, you do notice their absence or whatever. And doing the Barbary there has been very different to the Barbary in Neil's Yard. So I guess that's where the fact...
Why is that? In what way?
Well, I think, again, we haven't done a like for like. So Notting Hill, it's got the kitchen bar experience, but then we've done a dining room there, which is our largest one so far. So they are related Barbaries, but they have quite a different feel in many different ways, even down to the courtyard arrival of Neil's Yard.
Sure.
But it allows people, you know, larger parties to enjoy the Barbary, whereas in Neil's Yard, it's just 24 seats around a kitchen bar, which is some people love, but it's not for everyone.
So Evelyn's Table, that's your... Talk me through this location, because this is very interesting. This is your other
location. I guess sometimes should I say we get carried away? But being near some of our locations is almost why we've done them. So like the Blue Post was sitting empty for quite a long time.
Being near, what do you mean? But you
as in we're two doors down,
physically
near.
It.
So yeah, we saw it there, and
you
it was
saw
like,
it empty.
We saw it empty, and we just got sat with the idea for quite a while, and it was like,
your entrepreneurial mindset thought that we should do something with that.
Yeah, basically, and then there was like
the Blue Post was in a pub.
It is a pub. Yeah,
but
been
it was
there.
Just empty at the time.
Yeah, yeah, and then I think I probably persuaded my brother for us to put our hat in the ring for this one. We always joke when we've made good or bad decisions who started it.
Right.
I think I pressed for this one.
Is that because it's a good decision?
I don't know. Now it's turned into one. It definitely wasn't the easiest of all our openings. You know, you make mistakes along the way, of course. But there's about 40 people going for it, but we managed to win the competition.
Bidding for it.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like a little doll's house, really, because it's quite a small footprint, but we've actually made it three floors. We've converted the beer cellar into a chef's table, which is Evelyn's Table.
And that seats 12?
12, yeah.
That's all?
Yeah, that's all.
And as I understand it, there are two sittings, is that right?
Two sittings every night, 6 and 8.45. It's a tasting menu.
And does the chef determine what the menu is?
Yeah.
So yeah, you turn up as a guest and you get looked after by the chef.
Yeah, and there's some sommeliers.
And it's 4.9 out of 5.
Yeah.
So who's the chef?
Seamus Sam.
Right.
Who's been with us a couple of years now and doing incredibly well. So this is
a whole entertainment, isn't it, as an experience?
Yeah, it's not that formal. I mean, it's obviously very, the food is incredibly high quality, but the energy in there, because it's converted beer cellar, the music. But yeah, it is a whole piece. You're sitting there watching them prepare it all for you. And we do like a kitchen bar. And then you've got two front of house who are very strong on their wine.
What is it about a kitchen bar? What is it about that connection with the chefs?
For me, I feel like you're more in the experience than when you're at a dining table. And whether you're completely engrossed in your company or you're taking in the atmosphere, if you're watching how things are being plated, how ingredients are being used, it has something of a dinner party about it, even though you're not actually at one.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So a bit more like being in someone's home.
Yeah. If, you know, a kitchen bar, that's how I like kitchen bars when I'm enjoying them, is there is a little bit of, whether it's, you know, literally talking to the chef or the front of house behind the bar or not, but there can just be a sense that you're part of each other's experience if they're, you know, if there's an awareness of the guest and so on, and, you know, playlist, all these elements to it make it feel very...
So when was this one awarded the Michelin star?
2022 probably.
Right.
Yeah. About 4 years ago.
Was that a surprise or?
Well, at the time we were working with Lucas Selby and, I mean, incredibly talented chef. Really, it's always a surprise. You don't take these things for granted. But it was something we were hoping and dreaming of for the restaurant.
So that's fantastic. Mm. Oh, congratulations. So... you've now got this portfolio. You said you're sort of consolidating. Because when I suggested it was tough out there at the beginning, you said it is.
Yeah.
So what's going on? What's making it tough? Why did you say that?
I think it's been a build-up of things over a long period of time. Everyone's feeling the economy being, you know, whatever strata of society you're in, you're feeling it. If you were going out, whatever, once a week before, you might be going out, you know, 2-3 times a month instead. So people are having to, you know, think more about how they're spending their money.
Tighten their belts.
Restaurants feel expensive. The pressure on restaurants is immense because it's every possible frontier, from sort of utilities and rent all the way through to labour costs. You can't pass it all on. So the margins of restaurants have always, I mean, decades ago, were famously quite modest. So if you think that each one of these decisions is taking off, you know, single-digit percentages in some cases, it makes it very hard. And little things like, you know, decisions like tube strikes last week, it can really wipe some businesses out depending on their location. And a myriad of examples like it, really extreme weather, really hot, really cold.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of factors that
are out of your control.
Yeah, definitely. And the headwinds are really real. I mean, the last 18 months particularly has definitely been really difficult. And, you know, this is a massive conversation, but I don't think anyone's feeling that confident right now. So people are having to be more careful across the board.
And and your strategy needs to reflect that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it always needed to. But of course, like, you have to keep pushing harder and harder to make sure the experience is great, because you don't question value in the same way if the entire experience leaves you feeling better than when you arrived.
But no,
that is a lot of people involved in that experience.
So, as you've grown the business, do you feel that there's anything that's been lost or compromised or in the way you approach things?
No, I think we're probably on a tipping point now where the size of the company, the number of venues, making sure we get to everything, and that personal touch, I think we need to probably as founders evolve a bit in order to take on another business. You know, be lovely to do something somewhere else of our own. We've done a license arrangement in Sydney, but it'd be amazing to do something in another city. That would be really exciting. But I know that how we're working right now would have to change, because I know how hard it is just to have the four restaurants I've got in London, in different parts of London, and my office in North London. So, but I think that would now, we've hit four sites and being meaningful and, you know, on it co-founders, we need to probably change how we're going to work to bring another one into the fold.
Right, right. Sydney is a long way from London.
Sydney is a very long way.
Is that your first option? Or that
no.
Quite
we did this wonderful
adventurous.
We did this wonderful project for Gleneagles Townhouse when they moved into Edinburgh. And from there, they said, would you ever do one of your own brands?
We've got what did you do for them?
We designed a restaurant inside their townhouse in Edinburgh. They gave us an incredible room and a name they wanted to use.
Is that the one at the back on the ground floor?
Yeah.
I've been there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. So we did that. It kind of, the conversation had begun before COVID and then COVID hit and it got picked up. And of course, we were sort of trying to protect and run our clothes business and that came along. So it was actually rather incredible going up and down to on empty trains to try and bring this project to life. And it opened in July 22. And then from there, they then said, would you consider doing one of your own brands? So, and they had an opportunity in Sydney. So we wouldn't have elected to go that far away. But that opened a few months ago. So, yeah, but maybe being able to find partners to do something else in another city of our own could be a really interesting thing to get sort of broad enough and strong enough to do. But, yeah, we'll have to see what happens.
So you mentioned people might not go out quite so much. Do they behave differently when they go out? I mean, I'm thinking about alcohol consumption.
Mm.
So I'm told that people aren't drinking as much. Is that your experience? Is that not...
Some people are drinking more.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
But no, I think there is a general pattern. I think people take more pleasure in not drinking rather than just being like the old dry January abstemious piece. Like there's lots of lovely, incredible non-alcoholic offerings.
That's very true.
I enjoy drinking, but sometimes I might have work commitments the next morning. I don't want to feel fuzzy. I might start with a non-alcoholic drink and then enjoy wine with the meal. You see these trends a lot more. And something's health related. Some of it probably is budget related. But yeah, I think people are more intentional. People, younger generations are definitely more intentional about their health and well-being than in, you know, my prime.
So it's different from the nightclub days that end. You notice society changing.
Yes, definitely.
So you've had an incredible sort of career so far in hospitality. What would you say of the key lessons from your experiences? If someone was earlier in their career thinking of embarking into this world, what would your key lessons or pieces of advice for them be?
I think, look, you're going to make mistakes, being able to connect with things that aren't quite right. I mean, people-led businesses that aren't quite right, because the more you connect with them, the more you can remedy them. I think things are always moving around. Like I can have businesses now that are the stronger of the two out of the four, and then that wasn't the case. So always having faith. Fortune's always hiding. I think you need
Fortune's always hiding. What does that mean?
Well, I just feel like sometimes you can have a business and then you can make some changes that you couldn't have seen before, and it completely alters the shape of that business positively. And I've seen that in our businesses, nearly all of them, I think, along the way.
I know why they keep making you managing director. Fortune's always hiding and you can find it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so.
That's an interesting insight. So you look for it. So sometimes it's just a different...
Yeah, you can do things at a different time. It's really easy to feel defeated as well, whether they're your own things you've got right or wrong, or things going on outside in the macroeconomic. But I think, you know, keep pushing, trying to be better at what you started out to be. There's always room for improvements. There's always room for new ideas.
What was your best idea been, do you think?
Gosh, my best
idea. Oh, we love ideas here at Reed.
Oh, what's my best idea been? I think maybe holding on to the end was one of my better ideas.
Yeah.
Get back. I think that was would have been a terrible decision if we'd let it go. It was the most incredible place, and it formed so much for.
You may well not be doing what you're doing now.
Not be doing what I'm doing now, but it was an institution, and you know, it touched our lives ginormously and many others.
With your portfolio that you have now, with these different restaurants with different names, maybe call them brands, how do you see that evolving? I mean, because I mean, is that a strength, or how do you make it a strength? How do you see that evolving? I'm just interested in your thoughts around that as a strategy.
I think it's a strength in that it has meant that the restaurants have really resonated with people, team and guests alike. I don't know if it's, and I think it is a strength in some way, like we've ended up doing some really interesting other projects because we had a portfolio so people could tap into. So we ended up doing an incredible project for Glen Eagles Townhouse, a restaurant for them. We've ended up taking the Palomar elsewhere now. It's probably in terms of scale and business speak, maybe not long term the best way, but we would need to hone in a bit more now and narrow.
So
down.
If you were to open another restaurant, would it be called Palomar or Barbary or something else?
I think there's a chance that we will go on to develop one of the brands next year, yes.
You'd look at taking one of those.
Yeah. Yeah.
And doubling down on it.
Yeah. I think
what are the advantages of that then?
I think being able to demonstrate scale. I mean, one of the challenges of our business is that we're constantly trying to hold together all these different identities, which when there's two of you driving that, now that we've got the Blue Post is three identities in one. You've got the Barbary Notting Hill, all ones we've talked about today. And then to keep maintaining them at their very best, they've all got different elements to them. Whereas if we honed in a little bit, we could focus more on, you know, still being informed by the location, the building and so on, but developing one identity or less identities would probably mean we could consolidate quite a lot.
Right. I mean, because people do both, don't they, in the hospitality space?
Yeah.
But do both quite successfully. So it's interesting. I mean, we're a uni brand, as we call it. We just put stick read in front of everything, which is not very imaginative. But it sort of means that when we do advertise, there's, a benefit that's shared.
Definitely.
So I suppose in your world, it's sort of what do you want to be known for, partly, isn't it? If you go to one of your restaurants, what is it that, you know?
I think the quality, and I mean, what makes a great restaurant for me is obviously enjoying what you're, you know, for the food and the drink, but that the wider experience stays with you. So I think...
But the wider experience of going there.
Yeah, the atmosphere, the hospitality. I feel like that places that stay with you and you want to replicate that experience by returning to them, obviously, is what we're doing. And I think it's touching all sides of somebody's experience. So you can get away with not having a great meal if you're treated really well and the music's right and the lighting's right, but really trying to hit all of those.
So the recruitment and training of the people who work in the restaurant must be incredibly important then.
Yeah, it's definitely really important, helping people settle in and really understanding the kind of essence of how we like people to feel in the restaurants and how to deliver the experience.
How do you achieve that? How do you sort of inculcate that?
By, I guess, having strong people in the team that help impart that knowledge, having a spirit of hospitality in the company already, because you can't expect people to give great hospitality if they're not feeling pretty welcome and part of a, you know, a warm environment.
When they join your group, the spirit of hospitality.
Yeah, definitely. And then it's training, it's who's, you know, letting them see how the service unfolds, touches we have in the restaurant to make people feel welcome, the knowledge of whatever part of the business they're working in, because the more you've got the knowledge, the more you can bring your own personality to it. If you're struggling with what you're trying to share with the guests, whether you're on the bar or whichever part, you know, you're going to not be able to give your authentic self. And I think the nicest moments are when you feel like you can hand over to somebody, you know, who's to guide your experience in many ways, because you trust that they're going to care about you having a good time. And that's sort of the bit that you really want people to be doing.
And do you think it's helpful for you to be physically present in the restaurant a lot yourself? Or
I think it is helpful. It has got harder and harder.
You've got more restaurants.
Well, I've also had children in recent years, they don't really like me being out of the restaurant so much.
What, in the evening they want to see their mum?
But I used to love doing the door of the restaurants. I mean, we always are very present if we're opening a restaurant. I would say now it's a bit of a challenge, the battle of trying to be in all the places that one needs to be. But I think it's really important to the teams. But we are very hands-on, Leo and I. We're forever going round to have different meetings.
So how do you divide? I'm interested in working with your brother. We haven't really explored that. How do you divide things up these days? I mean, you said how you did at the beginning with N.
We have stayed in the title of those roles. I think there is.
So what's his title?
He's creative director.
And you're managing director.
Yeah. At the time, of course, he was also travelling all over the world, whereas now he's full-time involved in this. So there, in many ways, the overlap is greater. We still are I'm naturally much more running the people side of the business. We overlap on a lot of good.
So what does the creative director focus on? Do they do the menus or? Was it the interiors?
I mean, one of the ways I describe it is that Leo is more about how things look and I'm more about how things feel, but it doesn't help us.
Who does how things taste?
Yeah, well, Leo, we both do that a bit.
That's
actually
an overlap,
yeah,
is
yeah.
it? Okay.
We can't both go to all the tastings. There's just too much to do, but we both do get involved in working with all the chefs, and we've got some development chefs.
So he's look and you're feel.
I think so, if we were dividing up, but you know, We'll collaborate on all the best decisions and the worst decisions. I often have to deliver the tougher decisions.
Because the feel is around people, I suppose. Well.
Yeah, yeah.
So isn't the look sort of determined once you've got the restaurant built and designed?
You're constantly tweaking and looking.
You keep changing it, do you?
Well, not changing the look, but it could be down to, you know, tasting, dish development. It could be how we're going to do the wine list. Different restaurants, we do it in different ways.
I noticed you changed the windows in Notting Hill.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought it was improved. So
oh, good, look, you like it. Good. So there's always creative decisions to make. How we're going to market something. I mean, the marketing, the pressure of restaurants now with marketing has changed a lot since I first opened a restaurant.
In what way?
Just now, you know, you always have to be experts in marketing as well as hopefully run a great restaurant. There's just the challenges.
So how do you do that? What are your marketing channels?
There's all of the social media channels, all of your own sort of contact with your guests, newsletter, any actual collateral assets in the restaurant, depending on how far you want to go into social media. I mean, we're not particularly doing things like TikTok, but these are all things you might be doing depending on, you know.
So what do you focus on social media?
Well, we have, you know, the channels for each of the restaurants. We have a Studio Paskin one, and then we have, yeah, we speak to guests.
Also Instagram, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Sorry, Instagram. Yeah, there are others you keep up with, but that would be the main one. But you just have a presence on sort of behind the scenes, all the sort of SEO, digital marketing.
And you have to do all of that.
Yeah, and we're PR, then working with agency or in-house, depending.
Yeah. So you're that's all to build awareness for your being there.
Yeah. And yeah, you need to, you know, you need the guest to have a good experience. The word of mouth is always the most powerful, but, you know, staying present in the, you know, online press, whatever, is crucial really to a restaurant.
Well, very interesting. So how do you see this business evolving then from here? You've alluded to a couple of things, Zoe. But what's your plan?
I think this year is, a lot of it's about, you know, we opened Notting Hill not that long ago. The company went up by, you know, from 100 to 150 people. I think this period now is a lot of consolidation, looking at how we're doing everything, maintaining and excelling in our guest experience, so that perhaps when we open 2027, we feel ready to look for a site for something next year. But we're definitely doing a lot of, you know, consolidation process.
And may I ask, do you have outside investors, or is this your
own?
We do.
Right. We have a couple of investors who are very supportive. And
So they're quite ambitious too, are they?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, this has to be aligned.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly.
Right. But
they're quite recent additions in expanding to Notting Hill. But they're really supportive of, you know, the journey we're on.
Well, that's so important, having investors that you feel supportive, isn't it? And you want to sustain that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're very lucky.
Yeah. Is there anything else I should be asking you about the world of restaurants in the spring of 2026?
You know, I think restaurants are generally very resilient places. It is challenging. We're seeing places that shouldn't be closing. And hopefully somewhere along the line, perhaps restaurants will get more support so that their margins can.
What do you mean by that? What would you like to see?
I'm open. I mean, it could be anything, whether it's on VAT or whatever, but we're going to have to do something to make the math stack up. We can't just keep going like that, because there will be.
Something to make the math stack up.
Yeah.
So there'll be more and more cost pressures that are
squeezing
margins to the extent that places are going out of business.
Yeah.
That's your concern.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think that's a good message that the sector needs a bit of support.
Yeah, definitely. It's,
I mean, that's what I'm hearing. I think it's good to have it confirmed. Hey, well, thank you so much for coming
and
talking to
me, Zoe.
Thank
you very much for having me.
I always ask two questions at the end, I guess. Reed, we love Mondays, as you can see. So what is it that gets you up on a Monday morning, Zoe?
I love Fridays. Monday mornings, it's
why do you love Friday?
That's just known in my house. I love it. It's Friday because I always associate Mondays with like the tougher stuff's going to happen. It's always a really productive day, but I often feel like it's going to be the day where any of the bad news from the weekend's going to have to be tackled.
Right.
But yeah, I like how densely packed Mondays are. They feel an innately very productive day, and I've got to catch up on all the sites, you know, what's been happening, sort of try and get ahead of plan for the week.
So that's what gets you up. The knowledge that you're going to have to get stuff done.
Yeah, it's a quite a nice... Some days you don't feel like you've got enough done and you feel a bit adrift, and Mondays always feel like a very productive day.
Right. And my last question from my interview book, Why You 101 Interview Questions You'll Never Fear Again, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
I would like to have moved on from restaurants in about 5 years' time.
Moved on from restaurants?
Yeah, I think really? about 5 years is the 5-year plan, yeah.
Right.
I have a fantasy to go and live abroad somewhere.
Right. So you want to build a business and then move it on?
Yeah, I think so. I'll be able to work in some way less full-time.
Yeah.
In the restaurants. I haven't worked out exactly how I make the dream happen, but the dream would be to be doing something. My partner thinks it's a beach bar. I don't think it's a beach bar, but something
it's
where...
It's not far from restaurants.
No, it's not too far, but he can run the beach bar.
where will this beach bar be?
I don't know. We need to do some research, but I like the idea of the kids growing up and doing their secondary somewhere else. And I never really got...
Adventurous.
I never really got Barcelona out of my system. I left prematurely. So whether it ends up being Spain or somewhere like that, that would be the dream, that I could get out of the pace of London for a few years and do something different.
Have a different pivot.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I wish you all the very best with that and with your business, which in my experience is fabulous. So thanks very much for coming to talk to me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Zoe. Thank you, Zoe, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Zoe or her restaurants, you'll find all the links in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.